Poor folk. April 8. My dearest Barbara Alexievna, how happy I was last night, how immeasurably, how impossibly happy. That was because for once in your life you had relented so far as to obey my wishes. At about 8 o'clock I awoke from sleep, you know, my beloved one, that I always like to sleep for a short hour after my work is done. I awoke, I say, and, lighting a candle, prepared my paper to write, and trimmed my pen. Then suddenly, for some reason or another, I raised my eyes and felt my very heart leap within me. For you had understood what I wanted, you had understood what my heart was craving for. Yes, I perceived that a corner of the curtain in your window had been looped up and fastened to the cornice as I had suggested should be done, and it seemed to me that your dear face was glimmering at the window, and that you were looking at me from out of the darkness of your room, and that you were thinking of me. Yet how vexed I felt that I could not distinguish your sweet face clearly. For there was a time when you and I could see one another without any difficulty at all. Ah me, but old age is not always a blessing, my beloved one. At this very moment everything is standing awry to my eyes, for a man needs only to work late overnight in his writing of something or other for, in the morning, his eyes to be red, and the tears to be gushing from them in a way that makes him ashamed to be seen before strangers. However, I was able to picture to myself your beaming smile, my angel, your kind, bright smile, and in my heart there lurked just such a feeling as on the occasion when I first kissed you, my little Barbara. Do you remember that, my darling? Yet somehow you seemed to be threatening me with your tiny finger. Was it so, little wanton? You must write and tell me about it in your next letter. But what think you of the plan of the curtain, Barbara? It is a charming one, is it not? No matter whether I be at work, or about to retire to rest, or just awaking from sleep, it enables me to know that you are thinking of me, and remembering me that you are both well and happy. Then when you lower the curtain, it means that it is time that I, Makar Alexievich, should go to bed, and when again you raise the curtain, it means that you are saying to me, good morning, and asking me how I am, and whether I have slept well. As for myself, adds the curtain, I am altogether in good health and spirits, glory be to God. Yes, my heart's delight, you see how easy a plan it was to devise, and how much writing it will save us. It is a clever plan, is it not? And it was my own invention, too. Am I not cunning in such matters, Barbara Alexievna? Well, next let me tell you, dearest, that last night I slept better and more soundly than I had ever hoped to do, and that I am the more delighted at the fact in that, as you know, I had just settled into a new lodging, a circumstance only too apt to keep one from sleeping. This morning, too, I arose, joyous and full of love, at cockcrow. How good seemed everything at that hour, my darling! When I opened my window I could see the sun shining, and hear the birds singing, and smell the air laden with scents of spring. In short, all nature was awaking to life again. Everything was in consonance with my mood, everything seemed fair and spring-like. Moreover, I had a fancy that I should fare well today. But my whole thoughts were bent upon you. Surely, thought I, we mortals who dwell in pain and sorrow might with reason envy the birds of heaven which know not either. And my other thoughts were similar to these. In short, I gave myself up to fantastic comparisons. A little book which I have says the same kind of thing in a variety of ways. For instance, it says that one may have many, many fancies, my Barbara, that as soon as the spring comes on, one's thoughts become uniformly pleasant and sportive and witty, for the reason that, at that season, the mind inclines readily to tenderness, and the world takes on a more roseate hue. From that little book of mine I have culled the following passage, and written it down for you to see. In particular does the author express a longing similar to my own, where he writes, why am I not a bird free to seek its quest? And he has written much else, God bless him. But tell me, my love, where did you go for your walk this morning? Even before I had started for the office you had taken flight from your room, and passed through the courtyard, yes, looking as vernal-like as a bird in spring. What rapture it gave me to see you! Ah, little Barbara, you must never give way to grief, for tears are of no avail, nor sorrow. I know this well, I know it of my own experience. So do you rest quietly until you have regained your health a little. But how is our good the Dora? What a kind heart she has! You write that she is now living with you, and that you are satisfied with what she does. True, you say that she is inclined to grumble, but do not mind that, Barbara. God bless her, for she is an excellent soul. But what sort of an abode have I lighted upon, Barbara Alexievna? What sort of a tenement, do you think, is this? Formerly, as you know, I used to live in absolute stillness, so much so that if a flight took wing it could plainly be heard buzzing. Here, however, all is turmoil and shouting and clatter. The plan of the tenement you know already. Imagine a long corridor, quite dark, and by no means clean. To the right a dead wall, and to the left a row of doors stretching as far as the line of rooms extends. These rooms are tenanted by different people, by one, by two, or by three lodgers as the case may be, but in this arrangement there is no sort of system, and the place is a perfect Noah's Ark. Most of the lodgers are respectable, educated, and even bookish people. In particular they include a chinovnik, one of the literary staff in some government department, who is so well read that he can expound Homer or any other author, in fact, anything, such a man of talent is he. Also, there are a couple of officers, forever playing cards, a midshipman, and an English tutor. But, to amuse you, dearest, let me describe these people more categorically in my next letter, and tell you in detail about their lives. As for our landlady, she is a dirty little old woman who always walks about in a dressing gown and slippers, and never ceases to shout at Teresa. I myself live in the kitchen, or, rather, in a small room which forms part of the kitchen. The latter is a very large, bright, clean, cheerful apartment with three windows in it, and a partition wall which, running outwards from the front wall, makes a sort of little den, a sort of extra room, for myself. Everything in this den is comfortable and convenient, and I have, as I say, a window to myself. So much for a description of my dwelling place. Do not think, dearest, that in all this there is any hidden intention. The fact that I live in the kitchen merely means that I live behind the partition wall in that apartment, that I live quite alone, and spend my time in a quiet fashion compounded of trifles. For furniture I have provided myself with a bed, a table, a chest of drawers, and two small chairs. Also, I have suspended an icon. True, better rooms may exist in the world than this, much better rooms, yet comfort is the chief thing. In fact, I have made all my arrangements for comfort's sake alone, so do not for a moment imagine that I had any other end in view. And since your window happens to be just opposite to mine, and since the courtyard between us is narrow and I can see you as you pass, why, the result is that this miserable wretch will be able to live it once more happily and with less outlay. The dearest room in this house costs, with board, 35 rubles more than my purse could well afford, whereas my room costs only 24, though formerly I used to pay 30, and so had to deny myself many things. I could drink tea but seldom, and never could indulge in tea and sugar as I do now. But, somehow, I do not like having to go without tea, for everyone else here is respectable, and the fact makes me ashamed. After all, one drinks tea largely to please one's fellow men, Barbara, and to give oneself tone and an air of gentility, though, of myself, I care little about such things, for I am not a man of the finicking sort. Yet think you that, when all things needful, boots and the rest, have been paid for, much will remain. Yet I ought not to grumble at my salary, I am quite satisfied with it, it is sufficient. It has sufficed me now for some years, and, in addition, I receive certain gratuities. Well, goodbye, my darling. I have bought you two little pots of geraniums, quite cheap little pots, two as a present. Perhaps you would also like some mignonette? Mignonette it shall be, if only you will write to inform me of everything in detail. Also, do not misunderstand the fact that I have taken this room, my dearest. Convenience and nothing else has made me do so. The snugness of the place has caught my fancy. Also, I shall be able to save money here, and to hoard it against the future. Already I have saved a little money as a beginning. Nor must you despise me because I am such an insignificant old fellow that a fly could break me with its wing. True, I am not a swashbuckler, but perhaps there may also abide in me the spirit which should pertain to every man who is at once resigned and sure of himself. Goodbye, then, again, my angel. I have now covered close upon a whole two sheets of notepaper, though I ought long ago to have been starting for the office. I kiss your hands, and remain ever your devoted slave, your faithful friend. Makar Devyushkin. P.S. One thing I beg of you above all things, and that is, that you'll answer this letter as fully as possible. With the letter I send you a packet of bonbons. Eat them for your health's sake, nor, for the love of God, feel any uneasiness about me. Once more, dearest one, goodbye. April 8th. My beloved Makar Alexievich, do you know, must quarrel with you. Yes, good Makar Alexievich, I really cannot accept your presents, for I know what they must have cost you. I know to what privations and self-denial they must have led. How many times have I not told you that I stand in need of nothing, of absolutely nothing, as well as that I shall never be in a position to recompense you for all the kindly acts with which you have loaded me. Why, for instance, have you sent me geraniums? A little sprig of balsam would not have mattered so much, but geraniums. Only have I to let fall an unguarded word, for example, about geraniums and at once you buy me some. How much they must have cost you. Yet what a charm there is in them, with their flaming petals. Wherever did you get these beautiful plants? I have set them in my window as the most conspicuous place possible, while on the floor I have placed a bench for my other flowers to stand on, since you are good enough to enrich me with such presents. Unfortunately, the Dora, who, with her sweeping and polishing, makes a perfect sanctuary of my room, is not overpleased at the arrangement. But why have you sent me also bonbons? Your letter tells me that something special is afoot with you, for I find in it so much about paradise and spring and sweet odors and the songs of birds. Surely, thought I to myself when I received it, this is as good as poetry. Indeed, verses are the only thing that your letter lacks, Makar Alexievich. And what tender feelings I can read in it, what roseate colored fancies. To the curtain, however, I had never given a thought. The fact is that when I moved the flower pots, it looped itself up. There now. Ah, Makar Alexievich, you neither speak of nor give any account of what you have spent upon me. You hope thereby to deceive me, to make it seem as though the cost always falls upon you alone, and that there is nothing to conceal. Yet I know that for my sake you deny yourself necessaries. For instance, what has made you go and take the room which you have done, where you will be worried and disturbed, and where you have neither elbow space nor comfort, you who love solitude, and never like to have anyone near you? To judge from your salary, I should think that you might well live in greater ease than that. Also, the Dora tells me that your circumstances used to be much more affluent than they are at present. Do you wish, then, to persuade me that your whole existence has been passed in loneliness and want and gloom, with never a cheering word to help you, nor a seat in a friend's chimney corner? Ah, kind comrade, how my heart aches for you. But do not overtask your health, Makar Alexievich. For instance, you say that your eyes are overweak for you to go on writing in your office by candlelight. Then why do so? I am sure that your official superiors do not need to be convinced of your diligence. Once more I implore you not to waste so much money upon me. I know how much you love me, but I also know that you are not rich. This morning I too rose in good spirits. The Dora had long been at work, and it was time that I too should bestir myself. Indeed I was yearning to do so, so I went out for some silk, and then sat down to my labors. All the morning I felt light-hearted and cheerful. Yet now my thoughts are once more dark and sad, once more my heart is ready to sink. Ah, what is going to become of me? What will be my fate? To have to be so uncertain as to the future, to have to be unable to foretell what is going to happen, distresses me deeply. Even to look back at the past is horrible, for it contains sorrow that breaks my very heart at the thought of it. Yes, a whole century in tears could I spend because of the wicked people who have wrecked my life. But dusk is coming on, and I must set to work again. Much else should I have liked to write to you, but time is lacking, and I must hasten. Of course, to write this letter is a pleasure enough, and could never be wearisome, but why do you not come to see me in person? Why do you not, Makar Alexievich? You live so close to me, and at least some of your time is your own. I pray you, come. I have just seen Teresa. She was looking so ill, and I felt so sorry for her, that I gave her 20 kopecks. I am almost falling asleep. Write to me in fullest detail, both concerning your mode of life, and concerning the people who live with you, and concerning how you fare with them. I should so like to know. Yes, you must write again. Tonight I have purposely looped the curtain up. Go to bed early, for, last night, I saw your candle burning until nearly midnight. Goodbye. I am now feeling sad and weary. Ah, that I should have to spend such days as this one has been. Again goodbye. Your friend. Barbara Dobrozhova, April 8th. My dearest Barbara Alexievna, to think that a day like this should have fallen to my miserable lot. Surely you are making fun of an old man? However, it was my own fault entirely. One ought not to grow old holding a lock of Cupid's hair in one's hand. Naturally one is misunderstood. Yet man is sometimes a very strange being. By all the saints, he will talk of doing things, yet leave them undone, and remain looking the kind of fool from whom may the Lord preserve us. Nay, I am not angry, my beloved, I am only vexed to think that I should have written to you in such stupid, flowery phraseology. Today I went hopping and skipping to the office, for my heart was under your influence, and my soul was keeping holiday, as it were. Yes, everything seemed to be going well with me. Then I betook myself to my work. But with what result? I gazed around at the old familiar objects, at the old familiar gray and gloomy objects. They looked just the same as before. Yet were those the same inkstains, the same tables and chairs, that I had hitherto known? Yes, they were the same, exactly the same, So why should I have gone off riding on Pegasus' back? Whence had that mood arisen? It had arisen from the fact that a certain sun had beamed upon me, and turned the sky to blue. But why so? Why is it, sometimes, that sweet odors seem to be blowing through a courtyard where nothing of the sort can be? They must be born of my foolish fancy, for a man may stray so far into sentiment as to forget his immediate surroundings, and to give way to the superfluity of fond ardor with which his heart is charged. On the other hand, as I walked home from the office at nightfall, my feet seemed to lag, and my head to be aching. Also, a cold wind seemed to be blowing down my back, enraptured with the spring. I had gone out clad only in a thin overcoat. Yet you have misunderstood my sentiments, dearest. They are altogether different to what you suppose. It is a purely paternal feeling that I have for you. I stand towards you in the position of a relative who is bound to watch over your lonely orphanhood. This I say in all sincerity, and with a single purpose, as any kinsman might do. For, after all, I am a distant kinsman of yours, the seventh drop of water in the pudding, as the proverb has it, yet still a kinsman, and at the present time your nearest relative and protector, seeing that where you had the right to look for help and protection, you found only treachery and insult. As for poetry, I may say that I consider it unbecoming for a man of my years to devote his faculties to the making of verses. Poetry is rubbish. Even boys at school ought to be whipped for writing it. Why do you write thus about comfort and peace and the rest? I am not a fastidious man, nor one who requires much. Never in my life have I been so comfortable as now. Why, then, should I complain in my old age? I have enough to eat, I am well dressed and booted. Also, I have my diversions. You see, I am not of noble blood. My father himself was not a gentleman, he and his family had to live even more plainly than I do. Nor am I a milksop. Nevertheless, to speak frankly, I do not like my present abode so much as I used to like my old one. Somehow the latter seemed more cozy, dearest. Of course, this room is a good one enough, in fact, in some respects it is the more cheerful and interesting of the two. I have nothing to say against it, no. Yet I miss the room that used to be so familiar to me. Old lodgers like myself soon grow as attached to our chattels as to a kinsman. My old room was such a snug little place. True, its walls resembled those of any other room, I am not speaking of that. The point is that the recollection of them seems to haunt my mind with sadness. Curious that recollection should be so mournful. Even what in that room used to vex me and inconvenience me now looms in a purified light, and figures in my imagination as a thing to be desired. We used to live there so quietly, I and an old landlady who is now dead. How my heart aches to remember her, for she was a good woman, and never overcharged for her rooms. Her whole time was spent in making patchwork quilts with knitting needles that were an arshin, an ell, long. Oftentimes we shared the same candle and board. Also she had a granddaughter, Masha, a girl who was then a mere baby, but must now be a girl of 13. This little piece of mischief, how she used to make us laugh the day long. We lived together, a happy family of three. Often of a long winter's evening we would first have tea at the big round table, and then betake ourselves to our work, the while that, to amuse the child and to keep her out of mischief, the old lady would set herself to tell stories. What stories they were! Those stories less suitable for a child than for a grown-up, educated person. My word! Why, I myself have sat listening to them, as I smoked my pipe, until I have forgotten about work altogether. And then, as the story grew grimmer, the little child, our little bag of mischief, would grow thoughtful in proportion, and clasp her rosy cheeks in her tiny hands, and, hiding her face, press closer to the old landlady. Ah, how I loved to see her at those moments! As one gazed at her, one would fail to notice how the candle was flickering, or how the storm was swishing the snow about the courtyard. Yes, that was a goodly life, my Barbara, and we lived it for nearly 20 years. How my tongue does carry me away! Maybe the subject does not interest you, and I myself find it a not over easy subject to recall, especially at the present time. Darkness is falling, and Teresa is busying herself with something or another. My head and my back are aching, and even my thoughts seem to be in pain, so strangely do they occur. Yes, my heart is sad today, Barbara. What is it you have written to me? Why do you not come in person to see me? Dear one, what would people say? I should have but to cross the courtyard for people to begin noticing us, and asking themselves questions. Gossip and scandal would arise, and there would be read into the affair quite another meaning than the real one. No, little angel, it were better that I should see you tomorrow at Vespers. That will be the better plan, and less hurtful to us both. Nor must you chide me, beloved, because I have written you a letter like this. Reading it through, I see it to be all odds and ends, for I am an old man now, Dear Barbara, and an uneducated one. Little learning had I in my youth, and things refuse to fix themselves in my brain when I try to learn them anew. No, I am not skilled in letter writing, Barbara, and, without being told so, or anyone laughing at me for it, I know that, whenever I try to describe anything with more than ordinary distinctness, I fall into the mistake of talking sheer rubbish. I saw you at your window today, yes, I saw you as you were drawing down the blind. Goodbye, goodbye, little Barbara, and may God keep you. Goodbye, my own Barbara Alexievna. Your sincere friend. Makar Devyushkin. P.S. Do not think that I could write to you in a satirical vein, for I am too old to show my teeth to no purpose, and people would laugh at me, and quote our Russian proverb, who diggeth a pit for another one, the same shall fall into it himself. April 9th. My dearest Makar Alexievich, are not you, my friend and benefactor, just a little ashamed to repine and give way to such despondency? And surely you are not offended with me? Ah! Though often thoughtless in my speech, I never should have imagined that you would take my words as a jest at your expense. Rest assured that never should I make sport of your years or of your character. Only my own levity is at fault, still more, the fact that I am so wary of life. What will such a feeling not engender? To tell you the truth, I had supposed that you were jesting in your letter, wherefore, my heart was feeling heavy at the thought that you could feel so displeased with me. Kind comrade and helper, you will be doing me an injustice if for a single moment you ever suspect that I am lacking in feeling or in gratitude towards you. My heart, believe me, is able to appraise at its true worth all that you have done for me by protecting me from my enemies, and from hatred and persecution. Never shall I cease to pray to God for you, and, should my prayers ever reach Him and be received of heaven, then assuredly fortune will smile upon you. Today I am not well. By turns I shiver and flush with heat, and the Dora is greatly disturbed about me. Do not scruple to come and see me, Makar Alexievich. How can it concern other people what you do? You and I are well enough acquainted with each other, and one's own affairs are one's own affairs. Goodbye, Makar Alexievich, for I have come to the end of all I had to say, and am feeling too unwell to write more. Again I beg of you not to be angry with me, but to rest assured of my constant respect and attachment. Your humble, devoted servant. Barbara Dobrozhlova. April 12. Dearest Mistress Barbara Alexievna, I pray you, my beloved, to tell me what ails you. Every one of your letters fills me with alarm. On the other hand, in every letter I urge you to be more careful of yourself, and to wrap up yourself warmly, and to avoid going out in bad weather, and to be in all things prudent. Yet you go and disobey me. Ah, little angel, you are a perfect child. I know well that you are as weak as a blade of grass, and that, no matter what wind blows upon you, you are ready to fade. But you must be careful of yourself, dearest, you must look after yourself better, you must avoid all risks, lest you plunge your friends into desolation and despair. Dearest, you also express a wish to learn the details of my daily life and surroundings. That wish I hasten to satisfy. Let me begin at the beginning, since, by doing so, I shall explain things more systematically. In the first place, on entering this house, one passes into a very bare hall, and thence along a passage to a mean staircase. The reception room, however, is bright, clean, and spacious, and is lined with redwood and metalwork. But the scullery you would not care to see, it is greasy, dirty, and odoriferous, while the stairs are in rags, and the walls so covered with filth that the hand sticks fast wherever it touches them. Also, on each landing there is a medley of boxes, chairs, and dilapidated wardrobes, while the windows have had most of their panes shattered, and everywhere stand washtubs filled with dirt, litter, eggshells, and fish bladders. The smell is abominable. In short, the house is not a nice one. As to the disposition of the rooms, I have described it to you already. True, they are convenient enough, yet every one of them has an atmosphere. I do not mean that they smell badly so much as that each of them seems to contain something which gives forth a rank, sickly sweet odor. At first the impression is an unpleasant one, but a couple of minutes will suffice to dissipate it, for the reason that everything here smells people's clothes, hands, and everything else, and one grows accustomed to the rankness. Canaries, however, soon die in this house. A naval officer here has just bought his fifth. Birds cannot live long in such an air. Every morning, when fish or beef is being cooked, and washing and scrubbing are in progress, the house is filled with steam. Always, too, the kitchen is full of linen hanging out to dry, and since my room adjoins that apartment, the smell from the clothes causes me not a little annoyance. However, one can grow used to anything. From earliest dawn the house is astir as its inmates rise, walk about, and stamp their feet. That is to say, everyone who has to go to work then gets out of bed. First of all, tea is partaken of. Most of the tea urns belong to the landlady, and since there are not very many of them, we have to wait our turn. Anyone who fails to do so will find his teapot emptied and put away. On the first occasion, that was what happened to myself. Well, is there anything else to tell you? Already I have made the acquaintance of the company here. The naval officer took the initiative in calling upon me, and his frankness was such that he told me all about his father, his mother, his sister, who is married to a lawyer of Tula, and the town of Kronstadt. Also, he promised me his patronage, and asked me to come and take tea with him. I kept the appointment in a room where card playing is continually in progress, and, after tea had been drunk, efforts were made to induce me to gamble. Whether or not my refusal seemed to the company ridiculous I cannot say, but at all events my companions played the whole evening, and were playing when I left. The dust and smoke in the room made my eyes ache. I declined, as I say, to play cards, and was, therefore, requested to discourse on philosophy, after which no one spoke to me at all, a result which I did not regret. In fact, I have no intention of going there again, since everyone is for gambling, and for nothing but gambling. Even the literary chinovnik gives such parties in his room, though, in his case, everything is done delicately and with a certain refinement, so that the thing has something of a retiring and innocent air. In passing, I may tell you that our landlady is not a nice woman. In fact, she is a regular beldame. You have seen her once, so what do you think of her? She is as lanky as a plucked chicken in consumption, and, with Faldoni, her servant, constitutes the entire staff of the establishment. Whether or not Faldoni has any other name I do not know, but at least he answers to this one, and everyone calls him by it. A red-haired, swine-jowled, snub-nosed, crooked-loud, he is forever wrangling with Teresa, until the pair nearly come to blows. In short, life is not overly pleasant in this place. Never at any time is the household wholly at rest, for always there are people sitting up to play cards. Sometimes, too, certain things are done of which it would be shameful for me to speak. In particular, hardened though I am, it astonishes me that men with families should care to live in this Sodom. For example, there is a family of poor folk who have rented from the landlady a room which does not adjoin the other rooms, but is set apart in a corner by itself. Yet what quiet people they are! Not a sound is to be heard from them. The father, he is called Gorshkov, is a little grey-headed chinovnik who, 7 years ago, was dismissed from public service, and now walks about in a coat so dirty and ragged that it hurts one to see it. Indeed, it is a worse coat even than mine. Also, he is so thin and frail, at times I meet him in the corridor, that his knees quake under him, his hands and head are tremulous with some disease, God only knows what, and he so fears and distrusts everybody that he always walks alone. Reserved though I myself am, he is even worse. As for his family, it consists of a wife and three children. The eldest of the latter, a boy, is as frail as his father, while the mother, a woman who, formerly, must have been good-looking, and still has a striking aspect in spite of her pallor, goes about in the sorriest of rags. Also I have heard that they are in debt to our landlady, as well as that she is not overly kind to them. Moreover, I have heard that Gorshkov lost his post through some unpleasantness or other, through a legal suit or process of which I could not exactly tell you the nature. Yes, they certainly are poor, oh, my God, how poor! At the same time, never a sound comes from their room. It is as though not a soul were living in it. Never does one hear even the children, which is an unusual thing, seeing that children are ever ready to sport and play, and if they fail to do so it is a bad sign. One evening when I chanced to be passing the door of their room, and all was quiet in the house, I heard through the door a sob, and then a whisper, and then another sob, as though somebody within were weeping, and with such subdued bitterness that it tore my heart to hear the sound. In fact, the thought of these poor people never left me all night, and quite prevented me from sleeping. Well, goodbye, my little Barbara, my little friend beyond price. I have described to you everything to the best of my ability. All today you have been in my thoughts, all today my heart has been yearning for you. I happen to know, dearest one, that you like a warm cloak. To me too, these St. Petersburg springs, with their winds and their snow showers, spell death. Good heavens, how the breezes bite one! Do not be angry, beloved, that I should write like this. Style I have not. Would that I had. I write just what wanders into my brain, in the hope that I may cheer you up a little. Of course, had I had a good education, things might have been different, but, as things were, I could not have won. Never did I learn even to do simple sums. Your faithful and unchangeable friend. Makar Devyushkin, April 25th. My dearest Makar Alexievich, today I met my cousin Sasha. To see her going to rack and ruin shocked me terribly. Moreover, it has reached me, through a side wind, that she has been making inquiry for me, and dogging my footsteps, under the pretext that she wishes to pardon me, to forget the past, and to renew our acquaintance. Well, among other things she told me that, whereas you are not a kinsman of mine, that she is my nearest relative, that you have no right whatever to enter into family relations with us, and that it is wrong and shameful for me to be living upon your earnings and charity. Also, she said that I must have forgotten all that she did for me, though thereby she saved both myself and my mother from starvation, and gave us food and drink, that for 2.5 years we caused her great loss, and, above all things, that she excused us what we owed her. Even my poor mother she did not spare. With that she, my dead parent, could know how I am being treated. But God knows all about it. Also, Anna declared that it was solely through my own fault that my fortunes declined after she had bettered them, that she is in no way responsible for what then happened, and that I have but myself to blame for having been either unable or unwilling to defend my honor. Great God! WHO, then, has been at fault? According to Anna, Hospodin, Mr. Buikov was only right when he declined to marry a woman who but need I say it? It is cruel to hear such lies as hers. What is to become of me I do not know. I tremble and sob and weep. Indeed, even to write this letter has cost me 2 hours. At least it might have been thought that Anna would have confessed her share in the past. Yet see what she says. For the love of God do not be anxious about me, my friend, my only benefactor. The Dora is over apt to exaggerate matters. I am not really ill. I have merely caught a little cold. I caught it last night while I was walking to Bulkovo, to hear Mass sung for my mother. Ah, mother, my poor mother. Could you but rise from the grave and learn what is being done to your daughter? B. D. May 20th. My dearest little Barbara, I am sending you a few grapes, which are good for a convalescent person, and strongly recommended by doctors for the allayment of fever. Also, you were saying the other day that you would like some roses, wherefore, I now send you a bunch. Are you at all able to eat, my darling? For that is the chief point which ought to be seen to. Let us thank God that the past and all its unhappiness are gone. Yes, let us give thanks to heaven for that much. As for books, I cannot get hold of any, except for a book which, written in excellent style, is, I believe, to be had here. At all events, people keep praising it very much, and I have begged the loan of it for myself. Should you too like to read it? In this respect, indeed, I feel nervous, for the reason that it is so difficult to divine what your taste in books may be, despite my knowledge of your character. Probably you would like poetry, the poetry of sentiment and of love-making? Well, I will send you a book of my own poems. Already I have copied out part of the manuscript. Everything with me is going well, so pray do not be anxious on my account, beloved. What the Dora told you about me was sheer rubbish. Tell her for me that she has not been speaking the truth. Yes, do not fail to give this mischief-maker my message. It is not the case that I have gone and sold a new uniform. Why should I do so, seeing that I have 40 rubles of salary still to come to me? Do not be uneasy, my darling. The Dora is a vindictive woman, merely a vindictive woman. We shall yet see better days. Only do you get well, my angel, only do you get well, for the love of God, lest you grieve an old man. Also, who told you that I was looking thin? Slanders again, nothing but slanders. I am as healthy as could be, and have grown so fat that I am ashamed to be so sleek of paunch. Would that you were equally healthy? Now goodbye, my angel. I kiss every one of your tiny fingers, and remain ever your constant friend. Makar Divyushkin. P.S. But what is this, dearest one, that you have written to me? Why do you place me upon such a pedestal? Moreover, how could I come and visit you frequently? How, I repeat. Of course, I might avail myself of the cover of night, but, alas! The season of the year is what it is, and includes no night time to speak of. In fact, although, throughout your illness and delirium, I scarcely left your side for a moment, I cannot think how I contrived to do the many things that I did. Later, I ceased to visit you at all, for the reason that people were beginning to notice things, and to ask me questions. Yet, even so, a scandal has arisen. Teresa I trust thoroughly, for she is not a talkative woman, but consider how it will be when the truth comes out in its entirety. What then will folk not say and think? Nevertheless, be of good cheer, my beloved, and regain your health. When you have done so we will contrive to arrange a rendezvous out of doors, June 1st. My beloved Makar Alexievich, so eager am I to do something that will please and divert you in return for your care, for your ceaseless efforts on my behalf, in short, for your love for me that I have decided to beguile a leisure hour for you by delving into my locker, and extracting thence the manuscript which I send you herewith. I began it during the happier period of my life, and have continued it at intervals since. So often have you asked me about my former existence, about my mother, about Pokrovsky, about my sojourn with Anna Fedorovna, about my more recent misfortunes, so often have you expressed an earnest desire to read the manuscript in which, God knows why, I have recorded certain incidents of my life, that I feel no doubt but that the sending of it will give you sincere pleasure. Yet somehow I feel depressed when I read it, for I seem now to have grown twice as old as I was when I penned its concluding lines. Ah, Makar Alexievich, how weary I am, how this insomnia tortures me. Convalescence is indeed a hard thing to bear. B. D. 1. Up to the age of 14, when my father died, my childhood was the happiest period of my life. It began very far away from here in the depths of the province of Tula, where my father filled the position of steward on the vast estates of the Prince P. Our house was situated in one of the prince's villages, and we lived a quiet, obscure, but happy, life. A gay little child was I, my one idea being ceaselessly to run about the fields and the woods and the garden. No one ever gave me a thought, for my father was always occupied with business affairs, and my mother with her housekeeping. Nor did anyone ever give me any lessons, a circumstance for which I was not sorry. At earliest dawn I would hie me to a pond or a copse, or to a hay or a harvest field, where the sun could warm me, and I could roam wherever I liked, and scratch my hands with bushes, and tear my clothes in pieces. For this I used to get blamed afterwards, but I did not care. Had it befallen me never to quit that village, had it befallen me to remain forever in that spot, I should always have been happy, but fate ordained that I should leave my birthplace even before my girlhood had come to an end. In short, I was only 12 years old when we removed to St. Petersburg. Ah! How it hurts me to recall the mournful gatherings before our departure, and to recall how bitterly I wept when the time came for us to say farewell to all that I had held so dear. I remember throwing myself upon my father's neck, and beseeching him with tears to stay in the country a little longer, but he bid me be silent, and my mother, adding her tears to mine, explained that business matters compelled us to go. As a matter of fact, old Prince P. had just died, and his heirs had dismissed my father from his post, whereupon, since he had a little money privately invested in St. Petersburg, he bethought him that his personal presence in the capital was necessary for the due management of his affairs. It was my mother who told me this. Consequently, we settled here in St. Petersburg, and did not again move until my father died. How difficult I found it to grow accustomed to my new life. At the time of our removal to St. Petersburg, it was autumn, a season when, in the country, the weather is clear and keen and bright, all agricultural labor has come to an end, the great sheaves of corn are safely garnered in the byre, and the birds are flying hither and thither in clamorous flocks. Yes, at that season the country is joyous and fair. But here in St. Petersburg, at the time when we reached the city, we encountered nothing but rain, bitter autumn frosts, dull skies, ugliness, and crowds of strangers who looked hostile, discontented, and disposed to take offense. However, we managed to settle down, though I remember that in our new home there was much noise and confusion as we set the establishment in order. After this my father was seldom at home, and my mother had few spare moments, wherefore, I found myself forgotten. The first morning after our arrival, when I awoke from sleep, how sad I felt. I could see that our windows looked out upon a drab space of wall, and that the street below was littered with filth. Passers-by were few, and as they walked they kept muffling themselves up against the cold. Then there ensued days when dullness and depression reigned supreme. Scarcely a relative or an acquaintance did we possess in St. Petersburg, and even Anna Fedorovna and my father had come to loggerheads with one another, owing to the fact that he owed her money. In fact, our only visitors were business callers, and as a rule these came but to wrangle, to argue, and to raise a disturbance. Such visits would make my father look very discontented, and seem out of temper. For hours and hours he would pace the room with a frown on his face and a brooding silence on his lips. Even my mother did not dare address him at these times, while, for my own part, I used to sit reading quietly and humbly in a corner, not venturing to make a movement of any sort. 3 months after our arrival in St. Petersburg I was sent to a boarding school. Here I found myself thrown among strange people, here everything was grim and uninviting, with teachers continually shouting at me, and my fellow pupils forever holding me up to derision, and myself constantly feeling awkward and uncouth. How strict, how exacting was the system! Appointed hours for everything, a common table, ever insistent teachers. These things simply worried and tortured me. Never from the first could I sleep, but used to weep many a chill, weary night away. In the evenings everyone would have to repeat or to learn her lessons. As I crouched over a dialogue or a vocabulary, without daring even to stir, how my thoughts would turn to the chimney corner at home, to my father, to my mother, to my old nurse, to the tales which the latter had been used to tell. How sad it all was. The memory of the merest trifle at home would please me, and I would think and think how nice things used to be at home. Once more I would be sitting in our little parlor at tea with my parents in the familiar little parlor where everything was snug and warm. How ardently, how convulsively I would seem to be embracing my mother. Thus I would ponder, until at length tears of sorrow would softly gush forth and choke.